And now a little more officially. Good evening, and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator. To begin, let me make a couple of preliminary points. We are pleased to offer an ongoing series of diverse events each season. The new events newsletter is just now available on our website and will be in your mailbox and at the front desk in the next few days, so keep an eye out, and I hope you will take a look and sign up for anything of interest. While you're enjoying our events, please recall that the library does thrive and prosper through the generosity of its donors. Tax-deductible contributions can be made at any time throughout the year. We particularly welcome underwriting for events like this one or for many other special projects. For more information, you're welcome to speak to me or to our development staff or see our website. Third, please silence your cell phones. Because given the topic of this event, I personally just could not stand the irony if it were interrupted by a phone ringing. Seriously, thank you. We do have books for sale in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery, and Ms. Jackson will be happy to sign copies following the event. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Maggie Jackson. Thank you. The lovely sound of a cell phone turning off. A couple of weeks ago, I saw one of the current plays at the Roundabout, which is about a family dealing with ADHD, and it's also entitled Distracted. It's a really brilliant set, consisted of layered fabric drops on which were projected scene changes, TV screens, text messages, video games, classroom chalkboards, and so on, sometimes related to the plot, often not. During intermission, I went out to check my voicemail. I hung around outside the stage door to meet the actors, and everybody was looking through the viewfinders of their digital cameras. This is modern life in the first world, whether we're individually diagnosed with attention deficit or not. Maggie Jackson is one of the few people paying close attention to our lack of attention, and that night at the theater drove home the lessons of her book, Distracted. Maggie has, in fact, been paying attention to the problems of distraction for a long time. Her first book, What's Happening to Home, examined the overlap of home and workplace, and her award-winning column in the Boston Globe often deals with the social impact of technology. Distracted, published last June, was named a best summer book of 2008 by the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and has been featured in the New York Times, Business Week, Wired, Vanity Fair, the London Sunday Times, and other media worldwide. Publishers Weekly calls it a richly detailed and passionately argued account of the travails facing an ADD society and how to reinvigorate a renaissance of attention. And the Wall Street Journal adds that it concentrates the mind on a real problem of modern life. I was pleased to hear that it just went into its third printing. It's heartening to know that so many readers are, in fact, paying attention. Please join me now in turning our attention to author Maggie Jackson.
Thank you, Sarah, for that very nice announcement, introduction. And I'd like to thank Sarah, Mark, and all the staff at the Society Library for making this a haven of focus for readers, writers, and thinkers, no matter what your age. I'd also like to thank my agent, Emma Sweeney, for paying attention closely to this topic and to Distracted from the get-go, and for all her support and for being here tonight. Picture Freud on a warm September evening in 1907 in Rome, in the Piazza Colonna. He's watching a lantern slideshow, a short films and still slides projected on the roof of a house in the piazza. And every time he tries to move away, as he writes later, there's a certain tension in the attentive crowd that keeps him gazing. He remains, in his words, spellbound, until finally he feels lonely in the crowd and returns to his hotel to write a letter home to his family. Consider this great thinker, far from home, entranced by the precursor of media that envelop us today. The automated worlds that seized Freud just momentarily now shadow us 24/7. They're portable frontiers offering streams of communications, information, alternate realities. Now, picture two telegraph operators, separated by miles, flirting, bantering, falling in love in Morse code. He comes to meet her. They're tongue-tied until they string a wire across two rooms of a boarding house and he proposes virtually. This is a scene from Wired Love, an 1890 novel that was inspired by the real affairs of telegraph operators up and down the line in the 19th century. This realm of cyberspace that we wrestle with today and that is our meeting ground is not as new as we might think. And finally, fast forward. Picture a 21st century child, maybe your own, doing their homework. They're exposed to nearly 5 hours of non-print media a day. A third of this child and their peers will juggle 5 to 8 media while they're doing their homework. And 60% will multitask their way through their studies. And who are their role models? The average office worker, information worker, switches tasks every 3 minutes throughout the day, hopscotching from email to IM to new beep in their horizons. Half of these interruptions are self-imposed, external and internal. And half of us check our email while we're on the phone with another person. 40% of drivers age 16 to 27 text message while they're at the wheel. We've come a long way from the Piazza Colonna. We've created a culture of speed and overload and computation and collaboration and distraction. Distraction, which now means diversion, for better or worse, once upon a time meant being scattered, pulled in pieces, splintered. It's an archaic definition that fell out of use in the 18th century. But it aptly describes how many of us feel today. We connect with millions of people around the world, and yet as a culture, we have trouble sitting down to dinner with those we love. We tap into billions of information bytes, data surrounding us, and yet, are we wiser? Do we depend all too often on what's first up on Google for creation of our knowledge? Is this merely the new landscape of the digital era, the mark of success, the new look of the progress, or is something amiss, something called attention? Tonight, I'll talk a little bit about how we got here. You know, what are the roots of this climate of distraction? And what happens, secondly, when we splinter and fragment our attention? What are the costs and maybe the gains? Finally, how can we create a society that's high-tech and yet reflective and caring? Because this is the task before us. As crucial, in my mind, as digging ourselves out of this financial mess or greening the planet. Because we can only meet the challenges of our day by strengthening and undermining our powers of attention. So how did we get here? Well, the economist Jeremy Rifkin once wrote, "The greatest turning points in civilizations are often triggered by changing conceptions of time and space." So let's start with time. From the industrial age inventions of the cinema, the phonograph, the camera that tickled Freud's and other people's fancies, came the idea that we could do more than just mark time. We could control time. Humans could stop and start a moment of time, run it backwards. I mean, what was the phonograph but a vehicle for preserving the voice of even the dead? And simultaneity entranced writers and artists like James Joyce. Ulysses, in the critic Stephen Kern's words, turned one June day in Dublin into a vast, expanded present. Frederick Taylor, in Offices, was the efficiency guru who taught people to fragment work into pieces to make it go faster, so we could be more efficient, so that we could cheat the clock. Now, we layer the moment. We do 2, 3, 4 things at once, seeking the ticket to efficiency, the ticket to progress. Time splicing seems the answer to keeping up with all that we are coping with. This is why multitasking is our national pastime. And I was in Detroit last summer on a family vacation. I was a passenger in a car on a highway. We were barreling down the road and passed on the right by a man speeding by with a magazine propped up against his steering wheel. But I was the only person in our car who was surprised. Multitasking. We now layer time, and that changes how we manage our days and how we manage our attention. Second, where are we? Because the experiences of space and place that we're encountering have changed just as much as our experiences of time. When George Washington died in 1799 in Virginia, it took a week for the news to reach New York. When, in 1963, 70% of Americans knew in a half an hour that JFK had been assassinated. Bang! Global. We're global. The railroad, the jet, the car, the telegraph collapse distance and bring us closer together psychologically and in communications. We're now experiencing the lowest levels of residential mobility since the post-war era. Just 14% of Americans change houses every year. And yet, the number of miles that we drive has risen 80% in the last 20 years. Now our vocabulary denotes movement and portability. We talk about hot desking, grazing, travel soccer, dashboard dining. In a recent year, there were 1,400 products with the word go in the label, and that was a 50% rise from the year before. Cullen Murphy, the Atlantic writer, recently wrote, "Observe the contents of a stranger's briefcase. In all likelihood, the owner could be transported unexpectedly to Alma-Ata or Baku and still retain full access to power, money, and freshness of breath." The cultural geographer Yifu Tuan defines place as a realm of pause. And space, he says, is a canvas for movement. We have chosen space. We flip between people and tasks, we layer the moment, we keep one eye on the road, and we inhabit, not just tiptoe into, we inhabit multiple alternative realities where we do much more than exchange Morse code. Real money exchanges hands in cyberspace. Job interviews are carried out. Reality becomes a slippery concept. So what does this all mean? You know, global villages, hypermobility, layered time. The boundaries of our experience have exploded. We live in a world of what Zygmunt Bauman, the sociologist, calls shifting sands. And of course, much of these technological inventions and these ways of life are advancements. You know, we can revel in this freedom to move. Hop on a plane. You're in Singapore. The earth is shrunk. There are new iterations of community. We have access to oceans of information immediately, everywhere we go. And there are looser, freer relationships. It's no coincidence that in this world I'm describing, the social hierarchies are eroding from the boardroom to the dinner table. And we have a newfound connectivity. Just 10 years ago, it was predicted by many that the internet would turn us into pasty-faced loners, you know, sitting in our rooms. Well, we're connecting on steroids. There's one sociologist, Dana Boyd, who looked at the 5-year email archive of a guy named Mike, a 24-year-old Boston, guy who works in an art installation firm, not particularly technological. And when she looked at all of his emails, including group emails, she found he has ties to 11.7 million people in the world. We are connecting. But the flip side of all of these wonders and why we're struggling today is often diffusion and fragmentation of time, of space, and attention. Consider the fate of thought in the cognitive age. You know, 100 million websites, 100 million blogs at last count, and trillions of web pages. We don't even get enough into the deeper web to even see or access these. But we have oceans of data at our fingertips. But do we have the frameworks for making sense of the world around us? Do we have the architectures for deep thought that we so badly need in this age of information overload? And are we cultivating what William James once called habits of mind that can help us turn the raw data into knowledge and wisdom? I mentioned interruptions, the switching tasks every 3 minutes. Well, high levels of interruptions at work are correlated with stress, frustration, and even with lower creativity, according to work at Harvard Business School. I mean, this is why one reason people say so often, I need to get work done, I need to go home. Or, the only place I can think is the shower. And kids today, you know, who are multitasking their way through their homework, you know, they are scoring very high on tests of their ability to access or interact on cyberspace or to surf and collect and navigate these new worlds. But studies show they're not doing as well at evaluating and assessing information on the web. One SAT of information literacy found that just half of college students could judge the objectivity of a website. And there's a study out of UCLA, just one study, but yet gives a hint of why I hear so often from parents that my kids get A's and yet they multitask their way through their homework. This brain imaging study found that when students are studying while multitasking, they're actually using parts of their brain that are equated with shallower learning, less deep memory. They're not learning as deeply, and they're not able to transfer what they learn to new situations as flexibly. And this transference is the bedrock of experience and accumulated wisdom. So I believe that the tech tools that surround us will get more sophisticated. They will get more sensitive at interrupting us, and we will grow to use them better. And I also believe that we will begin to teach children what they need to know in the 21st century, the critical thinking skills that were not perhaps as prized in old educational systems. And yet, I worry that we're creating new forms of ignorance based not on a lack of access to information, but on the inability or unwillingness to turn information into knowledge. And I also worry that we're mistaking technological fluency, a facility with the mechanics of the tools that are so wondrous, with the ability to create this knowledge. Second, social contact. We're more highly connected than ever, and yet disconnected in so many ways. When people's core ties, their networks of friends and family, expand, not to only about a circle of two dozen, the types of interactions that go on change. People visit less, make fewer telephone calls. Of course, no snail mail anymore. But interactions by email rise. And I believe that we're increasingly depending on the most faceless, thinnest means of communication media ever invented. And the email inbox does more than just take up your time. It also creates what I call optionality. That is, when you can be connected with ever-increasing numbers of people in this virtual, boundaryless world, people are optional. You can click if something's awkward and turn away. You can drift off or ignore someone. This is changing executive recruiting, online dating, social relations. 25% of Americans now say they have no close confidant. They have no one that they can tell their secrets to. That's double the number that reported such isolation 20 years ago. And when I was doing research for my book, I went to LA to interview a MacArthur Fellow, linguistic anthropologist, head of a family study center at UCLA, Eleanor Oakes. And I wanted to talk with her about how technology would change family life after she had just completed probably the most in-depth research on this subject ever undertaken. And she wanted to tell me that people don't greet each other at the end of the day. Hi, honey, I'm home. Silence. I was dumbfounded. What could be important about that sort of 1950s relic? And we're connecting all day through cell phones and etc. Why is that important? Well, as Oakes told me, a greeting is a ritual shared by all human cultures. It is an acknowledgement of another at the cusp of a social interaction. It couldn't be more important for recognizing another, especially when you're coming back into the social fold. And then I talked to families, thinking that this would be a funny column. And people were joking at first, the dog is the welcome committee, and it became a poignant and moving subject for people to discuss that they weren't greeted when they came home. According to Oakes, only half of husbands and a third of wives offer a greeting, because, and children most of the time don't even look up. I can understand that. And because usually they're so busy, you're distracted or doing something else. As Oakes also said, we need a disposition to be vulnerable to interaction. Those are her words. We need the disposition to be vulnerable to interaction one another. And she said, when we could be having a conversation, are we? So certainly, the potential of this new world is vast. Our lives are enriched by the visual media around us, the global mobility, the expanding connectivity, the information, even multitasking and skimming are new skills we need to promote. But yet, I worry that our climate of distraction is undermining our ability to focus deeply on one another and to problem solve. I worry that our new ways of life are eroding our ability to communicate, to connect, and to make meaning. Analytic problem solving, creativity, deep connection, astute awareness, long-term vision, these are the skills we need most in the 21st century. And what underlies these skills? Attention. Attention fuels our ability to focus on our goals and each other and not be abducted by distractions. Attention enables us to control ourselves. It gives us the self-discipline we need in this virtual, boundaryless world. Attention is key to awareness. It gives us our ability to have concrete perception of our surroundings and a long-term metacognitive vision of our journey ahead. So listen for a minute to the words of the renowned ADHD researcher Russell Barkley as he talks a little bit about the characteristics of this condition. Barkley writes, "People with ADHD are more under the influence of others rather than acting to control the self. They're pursuing immediate rather than deferred gratification. And they're under the influence of the temporal now more than of probable social futures that lie ahead. ADHD is a disorder of attention to the future and what one needs to do to prepare for its arrival. It is," he says, "a disorder of time." Can we afford to create a culture that undermines our attentional capacities? At a time of vast uncertainty, mistrust, collapse, can we afford to nurture an attention-deficient democracy, economy, family life? We cannot. But I am optimistic. I've talked tonight about the long roots of our culture of distraction and the steep cost to the hypermobility and split focus we encounter, costs so steep that I believe we risk a dark age if we do not change. But to recover focus individually and collectively, to spark a renaissance of attention, we need to better understand this crucial human faculty. We need to learn to speak a language of attention. And that is at our within our grasp. What is attention? Well, William James, the philosopher and psychologist from the 19th century, said famously, "Everyone knows what attention is." And half of neuroscientific papers in the medical literature start with that quote. We all know, of course, what it feels like to concentrate. At least I think most of us still do. We know what it feels like to walk into a beautiful summer's garden and feel the breeze on our skin, to smell the flowers, to be entirely aware of this garden. But to define and measure and map attention scientifically has been almost impossible for hundreds of years until recently. There's been an explosion of research into attention, and coupled with advancements in neuroimaging and genetics, scientists now actually are beginning to define what seems like a mysterious enigma. And when you ask a neuroscientist what attention is, they immediately and very confusingly begin to speak in the plural. Because attention is really not just one thing. There's still some debate, but most agree that there are three types of attention. I alluded to them just a minute ago. And also, attention is, I will tell you what the three kinds are, but attention is now considered an organ system, like your circulation and your digestion, in that parts of the brain and the body work in complex alignment to perform these feats of attention. And also because these three kinds of attention, or networks of attention, have their own circuitry, genetics, etc. So they're distinct, but work together. The first type of attention is called orienting. That's focus. It's the spotlight of your mind. It's what you need to focus on another or a problem. Second, alerting. That's wakefulness. That can run the gamut from a coma to a coffee buzz. You can be focusing on me tonight and yet be half asleep. Now, you have two different types of attention at work here. And these two types of attention, I must add, are why we're biologically interrupt-driven, because orienting, focus, and wakefulness are primed to allow us to stay tuned to the environment. That's why we're always seeking to open that email or responding to the beep and ping or the saber-toothed tiger in our environment. And finally, the third type of attention is executive attention, which is a package of higher order skills related to planning, judgment, and resolution of conflicting information. The headline news, as well as the fact that we can understand attention and that we can understand that there are different types of attention in our quivers, so to speak, the headline news is attention can be trained. There are fascinating scientific and psychological experimental works going on around the country, around the world, to map and track how attention can be trained. And it's not clear yet how long-lasting the gains are, but scientists are studying meditators. There's a whole new subfield of neuroscience related to studying meditation because it's not the only way, but it's a 2,500-year-old practice of controlling the mind and controlling attention. Second, scientists are creating computer-generated exercises that are actually being shown to train focus and awareness. And there are behavioral activities, too. But along with the internal resources that we need to tap that I've been describing in related to attention, I think we also need to look at attention and distraction as a social and collective challenge before us. In other words, we really need to tackle the climate of distraction. For instance, the value systems related to attention in our country. You know, what if we began to question that noisy, interrupt-driven living is the norm, or that rampant multitasking is the key to success? The vision of the successful businessman or woman in this country is someone who's so hyper they can barely sit down and hardly listens with more than an ear to those around them. I read an article just recently about the drive to create the quick boot computer in the New York Times, and quote, in a new age of impatience, scientists are trying to discover computers that will start automatically. Because, as one tech executive explained, it's ridiculous to ask people to wait a couple of minutes to start up their computer. And interestingly, different types of attention have been valued in different eras. For instance, the industrial age was the height of the idealization of unbending concentration, directed focus, and as a way of assimilating large groups of people into the bureaucracies, the schools, the factory systems that were being created in the 19th century. Now, what kinds of attention do we value? We need to put this topic on the table. As well, we need to start, I think, individually and collectively refashioning time and space. It can be done. We can actually declutter the noisy, split-focus environments that surround us, especially in public places. And we can think about refashioning time. You know, restore the integrity of the moment, for instance. Before there was clock-based time, human beings existed for millennia on something called event-based time. In other words, a celebration, a conversation, a meeting unfolded organically or according to social and cultural norms. Toddlers are still on event-based time. If you say the party's ended at 6 p.m., they're still having a good time. The party's still going on. But rich socialization, we can take a page, an inspiration from event-based time insofar as our proclivity toward allowing interruptions to fragment our social relationships. Rich socialization cannot happen without uninterrupted time. And without rich socialization, you cannot nurture and cultivate the synchronicity that's needed for deep relationships. And finally, the third and perhaps the most important way forward, I think, is to role model attention, to give the gift of attention to others. And in closing, I'd just like to read a couple of paragraphs from my book, quoting the most powerful words related to attention that I heard in the 4 years I spent researching and writing this book. I went up to Colorado, 8,000 feet in the Rockies, to witness the end of a three-month, the most ambitious neuroscientific study of attention training ever created. It was a three-month study of meditators, normal people, not monks, who had taken sabbaticals and had gone and were utilizing a specific type of practice called shamatha from Tibetan Buddhism that is supposed to train attention. And the results are still coming in. And I spoke with a fellow named Alan Wallace, who is a translator to the Dalai Lama, Stanford scholar, a physicist, and he was the leader of this attention training exercise, and especially the meditation. And this is what he told me. Attending to, caring for, watching over, looking after. There's a real sweetness to that, said Alan Wallace. Clad in a sports shirt and chinos, Wallace sat cross-legged on a chair in his room at the retreat, mulling over vocabularies of attention with me, savoring each as if tasting a fine old wine. Before I headed home, he preferred a last thought. If a person leaps in and sacrifices his life, you leap in, you save a baby, and then you die, you've given your whole life in one piece, said Wallace. That's a wonderful sacrifice. That's pretty good. But when we give another person our attention, we're giving away that portion of our life. We don't get it back. We're giving our attention to what seems worthy of our life from moment to moment. Attention, the cultivation of attention, is absolutely core. It really is the linchpin. It is the key. On the way back to Denver to catch my flight, I got lost in the mountain foothills and began to panic, seeing few houses or cars for miles. At last, a man in a pickup truck rumbled toward me, and I flagged him down. "Follow me," he said with a warm smile. When I asked for help, "I'm going that way." Thank you very much. And there are time for questions, comments, rebuttals. Greet them, yes, yes. Oh, yes, certainly. I'm a terrible greeter at the end of the day. but yes, no, this is all a matter of choice and free will and the collectively, bit by bit, the choices that make up the fabric of our society, absolutely. I think there are two reasons why people are fragmented, interrupted, split-focused to the point of overload. Because, as I'm saying, this is not all bad, but it's has mounting costs. I believe that's why we're at kind of turning point. There are two reasons. One is this idea of productivity. I mean, certainly Western, probably quintessentially American, that it's wonderful to tick off things in one's agenda. That's a kind of productivity that we can all love. And yet doing the messy, difficult, gray area problems, I hear again and again from people in corporate America, they just feel as though they go home at the end of the day and just put out fires. So we're not getting to those. But that the easy stuff is great in this world, you know, whether it's information bites or your to-do agenda. And secondly, again, you know, we are programmed biologically to not only get a shot of, a little high at the novel stimuli in our environment, but also our attention is caught by this. So children's TV, I mean, all TV, but children, tiny, tiny children's TV is predicated on the fact that they have no choice but to watch that because of the speed, of the cuts, of the change, of the colors, of the brightness. Their survival instincts are groomed to pay attention to that television. So I think it's a matter of choice and then the environment we've created to make the culture of distraction sing, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, boredom and distraction are subjective, first of all. And secondly, it is relative because what was slow in the 19th, 18th, 14th century, or fast in those days seems slow to us. So by ramping up, yes, we maybe are conditioning ourselves to be more bored. But when we get to the point when not only children, but anyone up and down the food chain has squeezed out all time for reflection, for pausing, and for doing any one thing. I'm not trying to turn us into monks by any means, and I wouldn't dare. But I do think that we've somehow gone too far. And yes, it's great to not be bored, but there's actually a lot written about the wonders of boredom and the pleasures of reverie. I think teachers would speak to that. Oh, sorry. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that there is an interruption of attention, and I think the fact that the cell phone and the internet exist, don't you think that's the basis of this problem that we have, this inability to be patient? It used to be when you wait till you get back to your office to pick up the messages, and now everybody knows you can do each instantly and expect an instant reply. Mm-hmm. Well, I think if you're maybe asking what role do technological tools play in this, I think they play a huge role, but they're not the whole story. I mean, I really did think, actually, that I was going to write a book about technology, and then I realized, really, the issue is attention, because, again, it's how we use the tools. I don't think these tools are in and of themselves negative. We need to use tools more wisely, but they're very influential. You know, you can't ignore that a BlackBerry is a BlackBerry, is not a stick, is not an axe, etc. So, I mean, I think the tools really are extremely important to this story of how we process the world. And this really is, at the core, a story of our relationship with our environment, our internal environment and our external environment, because attention is like a second skin. Everything that you, every bit of relationship with you have with this room or your thoughts or the person sitting next to you is through the conduit of attention. And so we're really dealing with an environmental issue, and tools play. But beyond the tools, the neo-nomadic hyper-mobility, yes, I guess that started with tools and inventions too, but somehow we've carried, it's also cultural value systems and things like that. So it's messy. Maybe I should go over here for a minute. Well, that's a good point. 6 months ago, I kind of, tried to, well, I was a little scared to mention the old dark age business, but now, hey, look at the headlines, folks. a dark age is really fascinating because everybody thinks medieval, serfs, etc., but there were dark ages throughout history. I'm not an incredible expert because there really isn't very much that it has pulled together all of the parallels of dark ages. But I did a lot of research on reading about different dark ages and whoever has created some characteristics of a dark age. I mean, Jane Jacobs wrote a book about dark age ahead before she died a couple of years ago. Harold Bloom speaks about this. Umberto Eco has compared our culture to the fall of Rome.